This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer. It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hi, it's Helen Farmer with you. You are listening to the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Your chance to catch up on expert advice, real life stories and more. In our psychology hour recently, in light of that Oprah interview, we were talking about family rifts. What causes them and how can we heal them? Dr. Chastity was on hand to take my questions and most importantly, offer up the answers that you need to move on, whether that means with your family or without them. And marking World Kidney Health Day, Dr. Mukesh was live on the line talking about some of the things we can do to improve our overall kidney health, but also any specific chronic conditions that you might be suffering from. Plus, kidney stone remedies. What do we need to know? And we've had a miraculous story coming out of Abu Dhabi recently, a pair of Emirati twins born with a rare and fatal genetic condition. It was gene replacement therapy that we were getting to the bottom of with Bajil Hospital. And on the alternative side, Nir Levi has created his own method of body reading. So this means unblocking energy in the body and perhaps looking at muscle tension as well. He was on air to explain more.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is our psychology hour and we're talking family rift with Dr. Chastity O'Connell. It's off the back, of course, of the bombshell revelations made by Harry and Meghan. They don't have surnames anymore. First names only, like Madonna and Sting, in their two-hour interview with Oprah. And here is a clip from CBS from YouTube.
I remember so often people within the firm would say, well, you can't do this because it'll look like that. You can't. So even, can I go and have lunch with my friends? No, you're oversaturated. You're everywhere. I've left the house twice in 4 months.
I myself was trapped within the system, like the rest of my family are. My father and my brother, they are trapped.
Their tell-all interview is unlikely to amend, kind of sort out any immediate family rift between the families. In fact, it's most likely going to add further distance. But though the reported rift with the royal family is being played out in front of a very public audience, family rifts are actually pretty common. Almost a third of the UK population are familiar with the concept of cutting contact with a family member or know someone who has experienced it, according to the charity Standalone. Around 8% saying they've cut contact with a family member, implying at least 5 million people in the UK alone have made the choice to no longer be in contact. And over a quarter of adults responding to a US survey by the Cornell Family Reconciliation Project. Reported being estranged from a family member, this survey, which is the first of its kind, suggested that by extension that tens of millions of Americans could be estranged from at least one relative. Dr. joining us on the line now, we've got Dr. Chastity O'Connell. She is the mental health counsellor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. Dr. Chastity, how are you?
Hi, Helen. I am fine, thank you. How are you doing?
I am well, having a good week. It's going fast, the weather's gorgeous. All is good in the land of Helen. I am feeling a little bit bombarded by the Sussex information. It's everywhere. But it does, I think, offer a really interesting jumping off point to talk about something that, you know, hearing from those numbers is actually increasingly common. People deciding that simply a relationship with a family member doesn't serve them anymore. They don't want to have that. And making that decision to cut contact. So family rifts. I know you do a lot with families and young people at the clinic. They can be a huge source of grief, of heartache, of pain, but they can also be a source of somewhat liberation and deciding to kind of go your own way, to paraphrase Fleetwood Mac. Can you explain, you know, some of the common reasons why these rifts, these estrangements might happen?
Sure. Well, like you mentioned, and this is an excellent point to highlight, family rifts, estrangements, they are common. They're as common as divorce. So it's something that is out there, and it's interesting because it's often not talked about. It's often very quiet. I think sometimes there's, and it's an interesting one to sort of explore why that is, but a lot of it has to do with shame and just how painful. So when you mention the grief and the heartache, that is very real and very much felt. So when we're looking at estrangement, there's different ways to look at it. Some researchers define it as simply as when you cut off ties with a family member. But then there's also this concept of emotional estrangement, which I think is that middle ground, and it happens to a lot of families where you are nominally involved, but when you're together, you are checked out. It is distressing for you. You do whatever you can to avoid that contact. So emotionally, you're not at all invested in the relationship, but maybe physically you might be a part of it. Mm-hmm. And so because of those varying degrees of what estrangement looks like, there's also a number of reasons why it happens. And one of the more common reasons is, of course, the stuff that happened in the past. There's an excellent book that just came out by Dr. Carl Palmer, and it's called Fault Lines. And he goes into, he's done a lot of research on it, and he's done some incredible work on understanding these conditions for estrangement, as well as exploring how to heal, what are the circumstances for healing. But one of the first ones he talks about is the long arm of the past. And this is where, if there's a history of harsh parenting, emotional or physical abuse, and usually estrangement happens between like adult children and their parents. So we're not talking about, you know, younger ones as much, but it's that, you know, growing up and that sort of awareness or burgeoning awareness, recognition that, you know what I went through as a child wasn't healthy, normal, whatever it is you want to fill in, whatever adjective you use to describe it for me. And in fact, a lot of sort of the, it feels like on social media, the flavor of the inner child work, the sort of healing from the past, the parentified child, a lot of that is based in this idea right here, which is, you know, you were toxic to me. I cannot have you in my life. I need to heal. And the only way I'm going to heal is cutting off contact.
Interesting. And I think sometimes it can be hugely negative. And as I said, sometimes it might be someone cutting you off and you being left with no answers and wanting to reconcile, but simply not being able to have that contact. And sometimes, and you mentioned abuse there, sometimes that might be an adult child saying, you did this to me in childhood or all the way through my years, and I don't want to have a relationship with you anymore. And I'm old enough to make that decision, and let's leave it in the past, which can be a hugely positive thing. So I certainly don't want to talk about estrangement being, you know, the end of a relationship in a bad way. Sometimes, much like divorce, can sometimes be a great thing. You know, sometimes it can be the best possible thing for a family. Messages coming in on this. If you want to share your experiences, you can, of course, and please, of course, be anonymous if you prefer. No name on this one saying, I stopped talking to my brother because he's never made an effort to get to know my husband and my kids. They've never met their uncle. And while I still miss him, he's a different person now. And in terms of any reconciliation, that ship has sailed. Sad, but I think it's just how it works. And Sunaina, sorry to hear this, Sunaina. She's saying, I had a row with my favourite auntie in 2014 and we never talked again, both consumed by our pride. In 2018, she passed away, and since then I've had a gaping hole in my heart and lots of regret. Pride can be the source of family rift. Be humble enough to reach out to the other person before it's too late. Any advice for Sunaina there, who sounds like she's really hurting?
Well, when, you know, that is actually when we're looking at the sort of reasons for reconciling or working through estrangement, the fear of regret is one of those. And so I think, especially in working with grief, it's never, although they might not be here, you know, being able to, you know, work through that, whether in counseling with someone, but even just, if you could, what would you say? What would you go back? You, just because they're no longer here doesn't mean that you still can't say things and have those conversations in your mind with that person. So, you know, I hope that's helpful. But just, you know, the regret, of course, is painful and very real. But, you know, and I know there's like different philosophies and belief systems and value systems around, you know, what happens after death. But to the extent that it's in alignment with your value system and belief system, have those conversations, you know, even with that person, you know, and write about that. What would you say? What would it mean? What would you imagine them saying? And they're still healing, and being able to process that relationship can still happen, even though they're not here.
Jesse, thank you. There's an anonymous message here saying, from when I remember, my father was excessively mentally and physically abusive and I couldn't go out to play friends or pretty much do anything. There was so much that I just shrugged off and got used to at some point. My mum sent me to India for my graduate degree, and that's where the brunt of all that trauma hit me. Insomnia, chronic depression, zero self-confidence. But 3 or 4 years of therapy and a brilliant counsellor in the US helped. We still live in the same house, but I'm able to manage my sheer anger and rage at him better. I don't see a permanent solution to this, though. We hardly speak, and we think it's better that way. Thank you so much for sharing that. Really do appreciate it. And many of you getting in touch with questions as well. Dr. Chessy, I wanted to ask you about healing a family rift, if that's what you want, which I think is really crucial, if that's something that you are striving for. If you haven't been in touch for a matter of years, and you don't, as we heard from Snowden, want to have regrets about that, how can you tentatively get in touch, test the waters and see where that relationship is? Because she mentioned pride there, and I think that can play a pretty powerful role.
Yeah, absolutely. With pride, you know, if we look at what's going underneath that, is that, you know, difficulty and whether whether it's inability or unwillingness, whether it's unwilling or unable to understand and work through what's coming up, emotionality. And what I mean by that, for some folks, that pride issue is about they're just unwilling to sort of understand the complexity of what led into that. And this isn't about, you know, condoning or accepting like what might have been abusive behavior, but understanding that, you know, especially if we're dealing with abuse, like they were a product of likely abuse as well. And so when we're talking about that tends to go with inability, which means like there is so much hurt and pain that we can't step out of it. And so it's like there's pride, but then we really need to unpack what's going on beneath the pride. I don't think I said that very clearly because it's wrapped up in so many complex issues. Let me try that one again.
Go for
because
it.
I don't want to make it seem like, you know, pride is, yes, it can definitely be a huge barrier for connection. We see it with marriages. We see it between parent-child relationships. We see it with all sorts of relationships. But it really is unpacking and understanding what is underneath that. And sometimes we're simply unable. Like there's too much hurt. There's too much trauma. There's too much stuff that's in our mind where we are triggered by that person over and over and over and over again. So it's reflecting on that and sort of asking the question, can I let go of all that's happened? And what I think is important is that that doesn't mean that you are going to be in this relationship where the person who, you know, the family member has unfettered access to you, but it's about, you know, what would that look like? So part of it is, can I let it go? Part of it is also, what is the creative option for what the relationship could look like? And the example that you shared from the person that wrote in, they were saying, you know, this is how we carry on. Not an ideal relationship, but it's ideal for their situation mm-hmm. and how to help them, you know, effectively co-live together. So I think a lot of how we work through it sort of understands what was leading to the estrangement in the first place. You know, I mentioned the past, but someone rightly brought up divorce. And, you know, sort of what are the circumstances around that? Problems with in-laws, money and inheritance, unmet expectations. There was someone that wrote in around how, you know, I really wanted my brother to get to know my husband and he made no effort. So, and of course, there's value and lifestyle differences. You grow up to be a different religion or, you know, you have a certain type of relationship that your family does not approve of. So by first understanding sort of what has led to the rift can help unpack what would that solution look like, if that makes sense. I hope that was clear.
No, it does. It does. And I just want to thank you, Trusty, for, you know, being that shoulder to cry on, that sympathetic ear that we really do value. Thank you so much for your time this afternoon. And I'm pretty sure Harry and Meghan should be reaching out to you very soon. So stay by your phone, OK? Have a good one. Take care now.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
This is your chance to get the answers that you need from a bevy of experts. We love bringing together some of the best brains and the real life stories as well from the world of health, looking behind the headlines. And asking you this afternoon, are you drinking enough water? Are you keeping your salt and sugar intake to a minimum? If you're smoking, stop it. Be kind to your kidneys. It is World Kidney Day on Thursday, so we're talking kidney health. And renal disease is a very real concern here in the UAE as a result of certain chronic conditions. Delighted to have Dr. Mukesh joining us, specialist in internal medicine at Canadian Hospital in Dubai. Dr. Mukesh, how are you?
Fine, Helen. How are you?
I'm well. Is it weird to say, like, Happy Kidney Day? Is that something you'll be saying to your colleagues on Thursday?
Yeah. In the state of pandemic, it's very, very difficult to say anything.
You've got to celebrate what you can, I guess. Now, this is something that's really close to my heart, because my dad had a tumour a number of years ago and he actually had it removed quite recently. So he's got one kidney now and is doing really, really well. But it's something that I hadn't really thought about, in honesty, until he became unwell. You know, the kidneys are perhaps something that we take for granted. And I just wondered if you're able to give us a little bit of a non-doctor, non-medical term description of what our kidneys do for us in our body.
Yeah, kidney basically do multiple functions. It will first function to produce urine, which is we are extracting water, whatever we are, any form of liquid we are taking, it is going after filtration through the kidneys, and urine it produces the urine. Another thing which main function, it is the waste products which are from the body, metabolism is coming through the kidneys, and waste product are being removed from the kidney. Okay. Kidney is producing hormone, which we call as erythropoietin, and it helps the body, it helps the bone marrow to produce the hemoglobin, to increase our hemoglobin.
So can I ask you then, when we're thinking about kidney health, what can some of the red flags be, the signs that someone might have kidney problems or even a condition?
The problem is kidney. If you ask me, kidney failure, how you will have the symptom. Usually, there is no symptom of the kidney failure unless it's reached to end stage. Okay, There are certain people, certain diseases which are most common causes of the kidney disease. Out of which I can say the diabetes is the major role playing, the major role, which is around 38% of the all kidney diseases people have because of 38% diabetes. And another factor is coming the high blood pressure, hypertension, and which is causing almost 26 to 27%. There are other certain diseases related to the inflammation or autoimmune disorders of the kidney, which is we called in our language is glomerulonephritis. That causes almost 16%, and other causes remaining are the 20%. Other causes like drugs, like we are taking the painkiller over the counter, that can cause a problem. Or other people are taking extra protein, which they don't know what it contains in the gyms, and that can cause the kidney failure also.
And in terms of anyone who hasn't got any, you know, red flags or, you know, any kind of high risk cause for concern, what are some of the things that we could all be doing just to generally keep good kidney health? I know water is going to be top of that list.
Yeah, the water, you should have been hydrated well. Another thing which you need to do, if you are a diabetic, you should control your sugar very well. And if you are hypertensive, decrease the salt intake, control the blood pressure. If your doctor has already given you the medicine, you need to continue the medicine, and your blood pressure should be in the range. The another thing which you need to check, if you are diabetic or hypertensive, you need to check every 6 months your serum creatinine, which is the function of the, it's a test for the function of the kidney. whether your kidneys are functioning well or your kidneys are not functioning well. If you're not diabetic, yearly you can check your creatinine. If it is okay, nothing to worry about, but just continue the hydration, and if any risk factor you have, just continue to control that risk factor.
Doctor, what does screening look like? How is it done in the clinic?
Yeah, a basic screening, if somebody is coming to check the my kidneys, basic screening is needed. You need a simple urine analysis. It will show whether you have any protein in urine, whether you have any red cells in the urine, or any infection is going on in the urine. The functional simple test of blood test we call as serum creatinine, that will tell me whether it is your kidneys are functioning, how much it is functioning. Okay, it's a simple one test will tell you how much your kidneys are functioning, whether they're functioning more than 80%, less than 60%. That's a single test will tell us. And third, you need to do a simple ultrasound to see the structural any structural abnormality in your kidneys. Because kidney, if you ask me, the chronic kidney disease, which we call as a kidney disease itself, we call as a chronic kidney disease or kidney failure, it divided into the five stages. First stage, CKD stage first, one, we call as a, like if you have any structural abnormality, if you have protein in your urine, or your function is more than 90%. Okay? As from the 89 to 60 is a stage 2, and from the 60 to the 30, it is around, you can say, the stage 3. And if you come from 30 to 15, it's stage 4, and from 15, less than 15%, it is stage 5.
A message here saying, are there any herbal remedies good enough to support the kidneys or supplements? Anything that you'd recommend, Dr. Mukesh?
Not at all.
Oh, I like it when you save us some money on having to buy vitamins. That's great.
Because we have seen, when back home, when we have seen, there was papers which says the kidney, it can happen because of certain herbal medicine. The problem with herbal medicine, as an allopathic doctor, we don't know what contents are there. So if you don't know the contents, and we have seen the studies that there was some damage to the kidneys. So we don't recommend any herbal medicine. If I know that, I can't recommend, but I don't recommend anything.
No, that's really useful. Really, really useful.
Yeah.
Doctor, I wanted to ask you about kidney stones and specifically around crystals in kidneys as well. Can you explain a little bit about why these happen?
Yeah, there are certain metabolic factors which you have. So there are certain belts in the like UAE is a stone belt area, or certain in back home in Pakistan when I was there, there are certain areas in Pakistan there are stone belts where your water contain the electrolytes having some problems. So they have the more calcium oxalates and uric acid. So you if like uric acid, this is from the diet. Mm-hmm. So these calcium oxalates are stones. They are coming from your water contained in certain diets high in the calcium oxalate content. So that is where the stones are being formed.
Can I ask about any home remedies for removing kidney stones? I've heard it's worse than childbirth, too, especially for gentlemen, to pass a kidney stone. Anything we can do to relieve any of the agony that someone might be experiencing?
Yeah, it depends upon the size of the kidney stone. If it is, let's suppose, less than 5 millimeter, the stone parts will pass itself. You need certain painkillers for the stone, and it will be removed by itself by taking more water. Okay,
flush.
So and do some exercise, jumping exercise. This will help to move the stone. But if it is more than 5 millimeter, then there is a chance it will obstruct your urethra. So then you will need to see the urologist that might remove this within a half an hour by endoscope.
Oh, that does sound painful. Sincerely hope anyone out there who's got kidney stones is quite all right.
Basically, it's less pain than the pain you are bearing from the stone.
Okay. Oh. A question from Jenneth saying, do UTIs lead to kidney disease? Is that the case?
Yeah, if you have recurrent urinary tract infection and there is a persistent always source, but you have to find out the source of your recurrent urinary tract infection. There might be your bladder is not working well, like it's not pushing the urine out. So if there is a residual urine always, it will cause the infection in your bladder first, then this go to the ureters and then to the kidneys. When it reached the kidney, which we called as pyelonephritis, is recurrent pyelonephritis, it will lead to your damage to your kidneys and your function of the kidney will reduce.
So if you could kind of wave a magic wand across the population of Dubai and make sure we're seeing some improvements on kidney health in the region, what would you like all of us to do?
Basically, the problem is in our here, we are not taking care of ourselves. We are not doing any exercise. We are not doing controlling our risk factors. We are obese. If you see, our obesity ratio is reaching up to 30 to 34%. Mm-hmm. So more than any part of the world.
So we need to be drinking more water,
controlling your sugar. If you have diabetes, you need to see the doctor regularly, control your sugar, control your diet, and decrease your salt intake, because that will damage your kidneys further.
Dr. Mukesh, thank you so much for your time. You can find Dr. Mukesh at the Canadian Hospital Dubai if you do have any questions that we weren't able to get to this afternoon.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
When a pair of Emirati twins were diagnosed with a very rare and potentially fatal disease, the doctors at Abu Dhabi's Bajil Hospital decided to use advanced gene replacement therapy on them. And it saved their lives. Leading the team who made this happen was Dr. Hussain Matlik, consultant paediatrician and child neurologist at Bajil Hospital in the capital. Dr. Hussain, how are you this afternoon?
Thank you very much, Helen.
I am a complete novice when it comes to gene therapy, much like I'd say probably 99.9% of the population, but you are here to explain exactly how it works. But before we start talking about the solution, let's talk about the problem that these young twins faced. What was the disease they were diagnosed with at just 7 months old?
Yeah, this is actually a twin with recently diagnosed with SMA, spinal muscle atrophy type 1, which is the most severe one. As everyone knows that this disease, unfortunately, is a fatal disease and rapidly progressive disease without the treatment. And it will affect almost, it will paralyze the patients. It will cause a difficulty in breathing, in moving, in swallowing, in speaking, and even walking.
Oh, goodness. And can I ask you, first of all, how rare is the disease and what is the survival rate, doctor?
Yeah. Worldwide, actually, the incidence of the disease between for every 11,000 live births, there is one. And, this is worldwide. But unfortunately, we don't have a clear figures in the UAE. Mm-hmm. But, the average rate of cousin marriage across the country varies from between 40 to 60%, which is very high compared with the other world. Mm-hmm. So personally, I guess the incident is more. And however, I am aware of maybe 10 cases or 12 cases in my practice.
Wow, it's incredibly rare. Can I ask, as I said, the twins were just 7 months old when they were diagnosed. How did the diagnosis take place? What were some of the signs that the family had picked up on that led them to bring you to you at Bajil?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, when first time I saw the twins, actually, on December 12th, 2020, they came to me with a typical weakness and severe hypotonia, and taking a deep history from the parents, and then there's one relative who has the vague symptoms like this, and he is in a chronic care facility. So to me, I confirmed the clinical diagnosis on the first visit, and then genetic confirmation was made on 31st of December 20. And this is now the genetic test is the main diagnostic tool for this, and it's available in the country in the UAE now.
And time, just of the essence, you know, how long did you have to decide on that treatment?
Yeah, actually, you know, because in general, in this disease and in gene therapy, the earlier you give, the best you will get the benefit. And to be honest with you, we arranged from day one, from the day, the first day I saw the patients, I started for the arrangement for the disease, because I was almost more than 90% sure from the diagnosis. But, you know, till we received the confirmation, and that's after a few days, and then we started with the arrangement and the request for the gene therapy for them.
I've got no idea what this treatment actually involves, and I wanted to ask you, can you tell us how replacement gene therapy actually works, Dr. Matlick?
Yeah. The concept of gene treatment in general, you know, is to fix the genetic problem at its source. So in this patient, for example, in this disease, SMA, each gene contains on two regions, what's called introns and exons. So the exon is the coding area. In this patient, the codon in number 7 is deleted. So it is abnormal. So it is abnormal means the protein that's produced, it is abnormal or very decreased. So the gene, based on that, it will be very short. So in this gene therapy, we are giving a gene coding to correct that specific a bad gene at that area in order to the protein will be produced normally. And this is the whole idea of the gene therapy, actually.
So what are the risks? I mean, the treatment did ultimately save the lives of the twins, but what were the risks that the family needed to be aware of going into that procedure?
Yeah, fortunately, there is no risk threatening life, but there is a precautions. You know, the medicine may be associated with an increase in the liver enzymes, and that's why there's some protection, which we keep them on steroid pre and during and for at least 1 month. And we are watching the platelets. Sometimes it decreases, and sometimes on the heart enzymes. But so far, there's nothing. I mean, we finished now 10 days. Thanks God, everything is smooth.
Oh, I'm so, so pleased. And I wanted to ask in general, away from this particular case, what other diseases and conditions can gene replacement therapy be used on?
You know, it is a new hope. And most of the monogenic diseases, like the autosomal recessive, I think there is a hope for them. And now, for example, the sickle cell anemia, there is a good hope for them, and the researching are running on. So most of the inborn era of metabolism, there is a replacement therapy now. So, I mean, the time, I think, is will tell us.
Really exciting time. Lots of research happening and hopefully lots of development in this area. Dr. Hussain, thank you so much for your time. Dr. Hussain joining us from the Bujail Hospital in Abu Dhabi and wishing those twins all the very best. What an amazing, amazing thing to be able to have done. I mean, my goodness, I can't even begin to imagine the relief of the parents. It is the future is today.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Nearly Right is one of only literally a handful of therapists worldwide to be practicing body treatment at the absolute highest level. And his method is based on one of the oldest healing arts in the world. We're lucky enough to have him in Dubai for another week. He's practicing at Saver in Jumeirah One. And I'm intrigued to learn more, Nir, I have to say, because I feel like an awful lot of people are in turmoil right now. And you've talked about the body healing itself and some of the methodology around that. So let's get straight into it. How can you explain it to people who perhaps aren't perhaps hugely informed on alternative therapies or aren't familiar with some of the language? Can you explain in simple terms what the Nir Levi method is, please?
Yes, with pleasure. Okay. First, in my work, I go under the assumption that we are part of nature. And this is making it very, very simple, understanding that as part of nature, there are some mechanisms that need to work in a certain way in order for it to work at all. Mm. Basically, under the advanced being that we are in this 21st century era, we are animals that have been developed through natural selection of nature for millions of years. This development led us to the place that we are today. Interesting enough that we not always have been so advanced as we are today, like the rulers of this earth. We've been another animal in nature somewhere in the middle of the food chain, but things have changed. And the question that we ask ourselves all the time is that change created any of the effect that affects us in daily life through our health, physical and emotional health? The answer is absolutely yes, because unfortunately we found ourselves surprisingly the sickest animal in the kingdom of nature.
I've never thought about it like that before. We are, of course, in a position as humans where we've created medicines and, you know, interventions and surgeries and highly sophisticated robot surgeons. But when we think about how we ultimately perhaps haven't evolved that well, if all of this is required, you have definitely have a point.
That's remarkable. Yeah, yes. This animal of us reached the moon and probably soon you will reach Mars. But nevertheless, every fly, snake or rat that goes near me is healthier than me. So I have to ask myself, why? Why is that happening? So we tend to see it because of the development of the language, the talking that we started to do 80,000 years ago, more or less. The only thing that makes us understand this point is the fact that we are the only animal in nature that due to the development of this language that gave us a lot of force is imagining. No other animal in nature is imagining. We are the only one. Means that all others live according to the objective nature or subjective emotional system. We created a thing that do not exist in any other animal brain. We call it biosubjective ideas. It's all the rest that are not really existing in nature, but we realize it as real. And it goes everywhere. You know, if you walk in the street in any country in France or in any other country and ask a person, excuse me, do you think France exists? He will look at you like you're crazy. I say, of course, France exists. Look around you. Here's the Tour Eiffel or whatever. And you'll tell him, no, oops, it's a bit of a mistake here. France exists because you think it exists. And I think it exists and the rest of the people of the world think it exists. But if we'll make a magician trick and make all the people of the world forget about France, we will stay with people and nice buildings and the Tour Eiffel, but France will cease from existing because it's an idea. But we see this idea as reality. It can be okay for an advanced being, but the animal that exists inside of us for millions of years, which has been more time animal than any other thing, definitely not advanced like we are today, is confused, creating a lot of dust and it's creating a lot of fog in our head. More than that, our physical body is trained to chase rabbits, climb trees, and hunt. Yes. This is what we did for millions of years.
Eat and procreate, basically.
Yes. And suddenly we stopped. Someone had an idea about 10,000 years ago that we are better living in compounds together. We call it agriculture revolution. And then we start doing repetitive movements. And these repetitive movements are not designed to this structural system that we are carrying. So this animal starts suffering from ailment of the body and a confusion that affects the emotional system. So here is the answer why we are the sickest animal in nature. And for that, we had to give an answer. We needed to understand what is the way out of this situation that we are in. So we checked it out. We went to the jungle and we checked the closest animal that we have in nature, which are chimpanzees, basically. They are very close in DNA material to us, maybe 2 to 3%. And we see what has happened when a chimpanzee gets mad. A stimulation hits him. It's moved along the body. And he do one thing in the end. He screams. He doesn't stop and think and say, am I bothering the lion or the giraffe gets annoyed here? You just do what nature asks him to do. Energy goes in, energy goes out. What did we do? We created a reality, biosubjective reality, cultures, religious ideas, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, monetary system and health system and education system. All of these do not exist in nature. But all of these teach us that we can express to a certain degree, but not more. We even take little animals and put them in a square room in front of a square board and ask them to express only with permission. It's a bit of a misunderstanding of human behavior in nature. So it's amazing because if we look at the chimpanzee and we see what happened to him and the fact that he is maintaining himself healthier than me, so I need to learn from that. And I need to adjust myself into the movement of Earth. We were living in a ball that if we will stop, minutes after, everything will die. As we are part of this ball, when we stop, we die. We can die in our shoulder. We could die in our emotional system. We can die in our digestive system. And this death is the accumulation of energy. Energy that we are receiving while experiencing stimulation and not expressing out.
Basically, what this can lead to, as you say, kind of so-called kind of death, whether that is emotional or parts of the body, but also blockages, you know, kind of a bit of a traffic jam in the body. Is that quite common then?
Exactly. Exactly, yes. Energy that comes in and not going out goes somewhere. And it goes to the weakest place of our body, and it starts accumulating over there. It's damaging the connective tissue, damaging the energetic system, it's damaging the internal organ, emotional system, and chronic disease. It's just a process that happens in the body. It's a very basic process.
How can you help us, Nir? What does a typical session with you involve?
Well, first, I'm putting the attention of the person in his or her ability to do some movement in life. Because if life is about movement, we need to move. We need to move from point A to point B. But as we are living in the 21st century, this complicated century, that every movement that we make in our life might affect the surrounding. It might affect our family, colleagues at work, or whomever is near there. And this effect will come back to us. And when we change, when we move, we start behaving differently. And people in front might look at us and say, whoa, we don't know you like that. What happened to you? Some of us take a step back and we say, we are not willing to pay really the price of movement. So the healing process starts with a contract that we make with ourselves, signing down and saying, listen, in order for me to get better, I have to agree that I will make the movement and pay the price of this. If I'm willing to sign this contract with myself, there will be a healing process. If not, there will not be a healing process. It's not imaginary. It's very pragmatic. And that's basically it. When we agree.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Therapist and body reader Nir Levi is in town taking sessions at Saver this month. He says pent-up emotions can stay in the body and manifest as physical illness. So I had to ask him about some of the common concerns that people have.
Basically everything. All difficulties of life, starting from the physical to the emotional. All of them are mostly based on fears. We need to understand that the biggest fears of humans is from death. No other fears are coming out of that. But you know, 4,000 and a bit years ago lived a guy named Siddhartha Gumte. We know him as Buddha. And he said to his followers, listen, future do not exist and past do not exist. The only thing that exists in your life is the now. Now, why are you afraid? Why are you wishing? Why are you desiring for things that might or might not happen? You might live until 100, yes, but you might die 5 minutes from now. And you have zero control upon it. Past is even worse. You're carrying on your bag, inside your backpack, all your experiences, and you try to move and you say it's too heavy. It doesn't make any sense. Now you tell me how many of us are concentrated in the now. Who is teaching anyone how to concentrate in the now? I have 3 kids. I send them to school. They teach them to invest in the future, to think of the future. The future is more important. And I ask them, what do they teach you today regarding living today? Nobody is mentioning that. So this is a bit of a tragedy in our perception of life. What do we try to do? We cannot go back to the jungle. In my work, first I'm connecting the people with their body, but I'm trying to convince them to bring 5 minutes of the jungle back to their lives today. And if a person learns how to be in his life 5 minutes in every 24 hours, this is a game changer.
How could we do that if we're not able to come and see you or anyone who has experience when it comes to healing and body work like that? And any tips for anyone listening who says, I need to be a bit more chimpanzee?
The thing that we can do is do the basics of life. It's breathing. It's bringing the surrounding inside to us and giving ourselves to the surrounding fully. If we will breathe fully 5 minutes a day while being conscious in our breathing, while doing normal tasks, we will convince the body that he is here. He's not somewhere in the future in his goals or somewhere in the past in his pain. He's right now. And when that happens, there is a chain reaction that's happened inside the body that convinced the body to drop the control and to drop the fears. And then we can live at least for 5 minutes for every 24 hours. Other than that, if we'll drop Buddha here and you look around, you'll say, my goodness, what happened here?
You've said before, Nir, that our body remembers what our conscious mind forgot. And what can that manifest as? What might people recognize in themselves or those around us if that is the case?
This is easy because the body is a recording machine. And as I said before, he accumulates because of our lack of expression. And then he starts talking to us. and in sending us messages. Somehow our left shoulder is in pain. Somehow our knee is in pain. Each one of these areas represents something in our life, something in our connection to nature, in our earth, in our water, which is the emotional system, or the earth, which is the base in our education and moral system, or the fire, which is our movement mechanism, or our air, which is a thinking mechanism. Everything represents something. We need to recognize these things, and exactly in these points, to create a moving mechanism or ignite movement in order for us to go back to life in this area, because in this area we are dead. And if we are managing to listen as more as possible to our body and do the right movement, paying the price, signing these contracts with ourselves, there is no problem. I can help touching the bodies and allowing energies to connect there and release here and release there. But the majority of the work will have to come from the receiver himself.
Mm-hmm. There's got to be an openness and a willingness. And as you say, you know, there's stimulation techniques, you know, it's, you know, releasing muscle tension, get energy moving, but it has to be a willingness to go into that room and be open to something that perhaps you've never experienced before. And I know, Nir, you are doing some talks as well during your time in Dubai. So you are at SAVA in Jumeirah One for another week. And there is a talk on Monday, I believe, and you can check Nir out. Nir, what's the best way of finding out more about you and your method if people want to do a bit more reading about it?
I think that through SAVA, people can get into my website and learn about what I do. I think that the goal basically is to open a school in Dubai with SAVA together and bringing this learning experience to people. Maybe schools of how to live properly and how to become better in life for yourself.
You are here for another week taking private consultations, and you can check out SAVA as well, the website, to find out where you can get in touch with Nir, learn more and go along to that talk as well. Nir, enjoy your time in Dubai. It's been really, really eye-opening and perhaps a little bit brain-frying to talk to you today, but I feel like we need to be opening ourselves up to different opportunities, different potential solutions as well. So thank you for starting that conversation today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, and have a great day.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is our psychology hour, and delighted to welcome something of an expert in that field. Ali Salama is a social entrepreneur, a speaker, a podcaster, an ex-pro athlete, and the Middle East's mental health ambassador. He also is building his mental health startup, Empower, and has his very own podcast, Apple's number one charting youth leadership podcast called Empathy Always Wins. Ali, thank you so much for sharing your time with us this afternoon. And I'm so pleased that this is clearly such a priority for the part of the world. But the obvious question is, what on earth does the Middle East Mental Health Ambassador do? What does that role entail?
Well, thank you, Helen, for having me. What does he do? I think that that's the biggest question. And it's very important to realize that as a youth leader myself, it all started by myself, and it started from personal struggle. And what does that person do right now? Well, at the moment, we're doing the first ever mental health report on the impact of COVID-19 on entrepreneurs. We're figuring out data, because before we can find solutions, we have to use the tools that we have, i.e. social media, pretty much everything we can get a hands on through the tech enablement that we have in today's world. So for me, I use social media, probably the number one sort of most followed youth in the region. I am able to like deduce pain points and be able to consult the WHO. My mentor is the World Federation for Mental Health President-elect Dr. Nasser Loza. And with the network that we have, we are just trying to make sure that we can provide the best help for, you know, policymakers that can actually make decisions and incorporate that that change within our ecosystems and within our communities.
It's a big undertaking, but I really feel like there's perhaps never been a more important time to be addressing this. What I'd like to kind of bring to the table is that point about social media, which has been demonized for so long. And to be honest, in some areas, rightfully so. You know, we've seen increase of self-harm in young people, young women especially. But there is such an overlooked benefit to social media, and that is that sense of connection and community and sharing. Where have you seen it come into its own, especially during the course of the last year, Ali?
I think social media is a yin-yang sort of thing, because It certainly did blow up in COVID. From 4 hours, usage is now, you know, being to top to 7 and 8 hours per day on an average sort of device. But let's look at how we use and how we educate people from a young age on mm-hmm. social media. And I think that's the biggest thing we need to look at, because I think in governments, institutions around the world, not per se in the Middle East, we didn't really take the impact of social media on our mental health seriously in the first place. So when something really took off and we were all forced on social media, we didn't know how to behave. We just didn't know the implications, the health costs of using social media when it comes to addictions and when it comes to all these things that you and I and probably everyone listening to us is kind of feeling. But I think there's also a great advantage to social media. That means, I mean, from a perspective of community building, right? I couldn't be able to have this message if it wasn't for social media. I couldn't be able to reach to the people that need the support, need the help if it wasn't for social media. But I don't think everyone is using social media in that way, because it's very easy to get sucked into the abyss of self-comparison and all these things. But what I'm trying to say is education can make us more conscious and more intentional when using social media. So I think that we do need a little bit of education, but I wouldn't be the first person to demonize social media more so than say we need more awareness. Just as we need awareness on mental health, we need more awareness on social media usage.
Absolutely. You know, it's not going anywhere. So the more we can do to teach, you know, the younger ages, and I say younger, I mean, you know, all the way down to, you know, foundation stage in school. And this is something that you've been speaking about before. You've been a keynote speaker for the Canadian mental health charity YouthSpeak. You've spoken to thousands of students from grade one upwards. Why do you feel like speaking about mental health at such a young age is part of your role and your passion?
I'm part of the statistic. I never believed in mental health, right? If I was at this age, being the person who was sitting in my audience listening to a guy, a male, a man who's, you know, who has a physique and talking about mental health, this would have really made me think twice. Well, why someone like that who I never thought would embody mental health is talking to me about mental health? And this is what I'm trying to sort of overcome when it comes to the stigma. It's because what happened to me made me realize the importance of mental health from a standpoint of someone who was super Egyptian, you know, living in the West. Until that person got into a mental health illness and recovered and stayed 4 years going to seek support and realizing the importance of being vulnerable, of, you know, seeking help, the importance of communicating, we're not taught that from a young age. And I think kids hearing this from a young age, seeing that this is the only way you can actually not just be successful, but have openness while being at the place that you're at, while feeling fulfilled. Because I think what we're at right now is a lot of people want to go and chase a lot of things, but the biggest issue is fulfillment. And that is what the message around mental health is all about. It's about how can you still do whatever that you want to do, but still feel happy and fulfilled and satisfied with the life that you have. And it's not more so anything other else than that, because that's what we're suffering from today. We don't think we're enough. We are always comparing ourselves. And we frankly don't know what we want, because we're running after things that, you know, is just bombarding us left, straight, right and center. We're just absorbing so much information.
Are you able to tell us, Ali, about your own experiences with mental health?
Yeah. So it was, I went to Dubai English speaking college here. I left to Canada when I was 17, a month before I turned 18. I just didn't, you know, I was the typical kid going to, you know, at secondary school or high school here, and I wasn't used to the Western life. No one can teach you the reality of what it, you know, feels like to go there. So when I landed there, I found it very hard to make friends, and I'm a very social type of person, but I wasn't accustomed to the culture shift. Slowly but surely, I just found it very hard getting into social circles, really finding that meaningful connection that I was talking about, being fulfilled and not just going out because I wanted to go out. And in 1.5 year, I just dipped month after month until I was showing up to class and my eyes were red and I had no energy and I couldn't sleep well and I just lost sense of time and all these things that, you know, I didn't know at the time were symptoms of something going, you know, sideways. And I couldn't fake it. I couldn't ignore it. And my mother and I had the decision that, you know, it was really going bad. I started to get thoughts that weren't really, you know, okay. And I just had to seek support. And this was my journey. And when I went there and when I went into my counselor's room and I saw people who were literally classmates, how did I not know they weren't okay like I was not okay? And I felt that we often hide under so much because of shame and the stigma. And sometimes it's all well and good when you hear stigma, 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 until you walk into a room and it's because of the stigma that you are where you're at, right? And that's my journey.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Great to have you with us. I'm in conversation now with the Middle East Mental Health Ambassador, Ali Salama. He's been sharing his experiences suffering from mental health issues when he moved to Canada from Dubai. And he's been speaking in schools, but also thinks it's incredibly important to reach out to adults.
It's not enough to just go to speak at schools, right? Mm. A lot of the people, you know, when I spoke at MIT, the Massachusetts, online, entrepreneurs have one of the worst statistics in the world when it comes to mental health at work. So, and one thing I realized is that people who go to work and don't have great cultures end up bringing that and end up sort of passing that onto their kids, and their kids end up talking to us at school. So it became not just about me speaking to youth at schools. It became about me speaking to the entire community, and the community has people, you know, going to work. And I think that the most important change that we will see in this world comes from business leaders, because business leaders have budgets. Those are the same budgets that they sort of hire myself or other people that go to speak and just make the culture a little bit more vulnerable. Like, what is it that you love about work? What is it that you don't love about work? What would you love to see? How would you love to feel coming and showing up to work every day? You know, all these sorts of things that enable someone to feel more comfortable, show up more like they are themselves. Because one thing that doesn't happen when we're not in great mental health is we often, you know, show up as someone else. We aren't ourselves, and that often creates more harm than good. And by the way, if you speak on it from a business perspective, innovation, creativity, that only happens when you can be vulnerable and raw, because you have that space to share yourself. So from a business perspective and from a personal perspective, that's why I say on my show, in life and in business, empathy always wins. It's from that empathetic leadership perspective, standpoint of view.
It makes so much sense. Unfortunately, I think there's an awful long way to go, because many of the people in power are coming from generations where it's been seen as a weakness to show vulnerability, rather than vulnerability, you know, is incredibly powerful. And as you say, it's when you feel happy and secure and safe that you can start to put ideas out there and perhaps fear rejection or fear discussion. And that's where progress is made. That is where creativity happens, where innovation happens as well. If you could kind of wave a magic wand and see, you know, one thing change in companies in particular, since I feel like this is something you're really clued into and perhaps where there is huge room for improvement, what would you like to see in every single company or every single company culture?
Yeah, I would definitely like to see a well-being workplace initiative, for sure. That's something that, you know, I believe needs to be tracked with clear KPIs and clear confidentiality. Mm-hmm. I don't think confidentiality needs to happen in a therapy room. I think it needs to happen in every room, right? I think we need to feel safe wherever we go. And if the more places we can make modeled around the room that we feel safe in, that's where work needs to be at. And until we get to that point, I don't think companies will be facing, you know, in Canada, we're in the $55 billion burden. You know, worldwide, it's more than $2 trillion in dollars being lost as a result of this burden that we're talking about, people not feeling like themselves showing up to work. So I think it's a matter of time before it gets there. But with everything that I'm doing, it's more around data. Without real-time data-driven decisions, we can't get anywhere. And this is what I'm solving right now.
And how can people get involved and find out more and even contribute to some of the research that you're doing?
If anyone's sort of listening and would love to get in touch, there's an array of things we can do together. But I would definitely love for them to reach out to me on my Instagram or via LinkedIn, Ali Salama, or via email at info@empowermag.com.
Ali, you're doing an amazing job, and what a job that is, the Middle East Mental Health Ambassador. I can't think of anyone more suited to the role. Thank you so, so much for your time today. I know you're incredibly busy, and as we said, we'll definitely be charting your progress, and please come back to us when you feel like you've got some data. We can look back at this crazy time of the last year, the world's biggest social experiment, but let's hope some good comes of it, right?
Thank you so much, Alan, for sure. After we come out with our first report, I'll definitely be contacting you guys.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Thank you again to all of our experts and to all of you. Don't forget, if you want to hear from experts live on the show, we're at Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5 every single afternoon. And of course, we can take your questions and let us know what or who do you want to hear about next. Don't forget as well to please rate and subscribe. 5 stars, please. It helps boost us in the ratings and allows other people to find us more easily. Plus, you'll get the podcast direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.